and inferior classification. You don't think we are spiritual people who attend to higher things as distinct from these morons who are only interested in beer and television. This is simply our particular form of life. Like there are crabs, and there are spiders, and there are sharks, and there are sparrows, and so on. The trouble with the human being is, like the trouble with certain animals, like the dinosaur, who evolved to the point where he was so big that he had to have two brains, a higher self in the head and a lower self in the rump. And the difficulty was to get these two brains coordinated. But we have exactly the same trouble. And we are suffering from a kind of jitters that comes from being two-brained. Now, you see, I'm not saying that that jitters is bad. It's a potential step in evolution and an opportunity of growth. But remember, in the process of growth, the oak is not better than the acorn. Because what does it do? It produces acorns. Or you could say, just like I sometimes love to say, that a chicken is one egg's way of becoming others. So an oak is an acorn's way of becoming other acorns. Where is the point of superiority? The first verse of that poem I just quoted, "The flowering branches grow naturally, some short, some long," the first verse is, "In the landscape of spring, there is nothing superior and nothing inferior. The flowering branches are naturally some short, some long." So that's the point of view of being an outcast, in the sense of being outside the taking seriously of being involved in the social game, and therefore being threatened by making mistakes, of doing the wrong thing. That is to say, of carrying into adult life one's childhood conditioning, where somebody is constantly yammering at you to play the game. So therefore, the preachers and the teachers take the same attitude towards their adult congregations that parents take to children, and lecture them and tell them what they should do. And judges in courts feel also entitled to give people lectures, because they say those criminal types haven't grown up, but neither have the judges. It takes two to make a quarrel. So one can begin to think in a new way, in the polarity thinking, instead of being stuck with the competitive thinking of the good guys and the bad guys, the cops and the robbers, the capitalists and the communists, all these things, which are simply childishness. Now, of course, you recognize that the moment I say that, it's like talking in English in order to show that the English language has limitations. And I am talking in a language that seems competitive to show that the competitive game has limitations. As if I were saying to all you cats here, look, I have something to tell you that is, and if you get this, you'll be in a better position than you were before you heard it. But I cannot speak to this group or this society or this language-speaking culture without using the language, the gestures, the customs, etc., that you have. The Zen masters try to get around this by doing things suddenly that people just don't get. Well, what is this? Therefore, that is the reason why, this is the real reason why, Zen cannot be explained. You have to make, as it were, a jump from the valuation game of better people and worse people, in groups and out groups. And you can only make it by seeing that they all are mutually interdependent. So if we take this situation, let's say I would be talking to you and saying, look, I have some very special thing that you've got to take notice of. Therefore, I am the in-group, and I am the teacher, and you are the out-group. I know perfectly well that I cannot be the teacher unless you come here. And so that my status and my position is totally dependent on you. It isn't something you see, therefore I have first, and then you get. These things arise mutually. So if you wouldn't come, I wouldn't talk. I wouldn't know what to say. Because I've borrowed your language. So that is the insight that things go together. Then, when you see that and aren't in competition, then you don't make a mistake because you don't dither. When I first learned the piano and played these wretched scales, the teacher beside me had a pencil in her hand and she hit my fingers every time I made a wrong note. Consequent was I never learned to read music, because I hesitated too long to play the note on time. Because I was always, is this pencil going to land? See? And that gets built into your psyche. And so people are always, although they're adults and nobody is clubbing them around and screaming at them any longer, they hear the echoes of that screaming mama or that bombinating papa in the back of their heads all their life long. And so they adopt the same attitudes to their own children, and the farce continues. Because there is no, I mean, I don't say that you shouldn't lay down the law to children if you want them to play the social game. But if you lay down the law to your children, you must make provision later in life for them to be liberated, to go through a process of curing them from the bad effects of education. But you can't do that unless you too grow up, you see, unless we grow up. Says I, including myself. So that is the thing. Now, therefore, in the Zen scene, you would think that the master, as we know him and as we read about him, is an extremely authoritarian figure. That's the way he deliberately comes on at the beginning. He puts up a terrific show of being an awful dragon. And this screens out all sorts of people who don't have somehow the nerve to get into the work. But once you are in, a very strange change takes place. The master becomes the brother. He becomes the affectionate helper of all those students. And they love him as they would a brother, rather than respect him as they would a father. And therefore the students and masters, they make jokes about each other. They have a very curious kind of social relationship, which has all the outward trappings of the authoritarian. But everybody knows on the inside that that's a joke. Liberated people have to be very cool. Otherwise, in a society which doesn't believe in equality and cannot possibly practice it, they would be considered extremely subversive. And therefore, great Zen masters wear purple and gold and carry scepters and sit in thrones. And all this is carried on to cool it. And the outside world knows, oh, they're all right. They have discipline, they have order, they're perfectly fine.
Out of Your Mind now continues with the next lecture from the World as Just So lecture series.
Having discussed basic principles of what Zen is about, I'm passing on to the more practical side of it. A Zen monastery is not a monastery in the Christian sense. It's more like a theological seminary
except that it practices more than it teaches. A typical institution consists of a campus. And on the campus, there are many buildings. First of all, around the edges, you will invariably find independent temples that were founded in times past by noble families. Because one of the things that the Buddhists did when they came to the Far East was they exploited ancestor worship. This was very clever of them. This being the great religion of China, the Buddhist priests performed services like requiem masses for the repose of the souls or for good incarnation, reincarnations for one's ancestors, and they made quite a thing out of that. And so they have memorial services for the departed, and that's one of the principal functions of temples in Japan. People don't go to temple in the same way as Westerners go to church. They make pilgrimages to temples, and say at a great temple like Eheiji, you will find on a Sunday morning, or practically any morning, a swarm of about 500 people attending the 4 a.m. service of chanting the Buddhist scriptures. But they are kind of in and out of their temples. They have special services. They have memorial services, weddings, funerals, or everything like that. But they don't have a parish kind of church community as we find it in the West. Although when Buddhism, through the Japanese immigrants, exports itself to the United States, they immediately copy the Protestant church institution and sing, Buddha loves me, this I know, for the sutra tells me so. It's terrible. And all the young men, Nisei, who have never been in Japan, the one thing they can't stand is sutra chanting. Because they don't know what it means, and the priests don't know what it means a lot of the time. But it's beautiful to listen to, and they haven't got an educated Western ear yet to appreciate that kind of Oriental music. Well now, aside from these many temples, each of which is in charge of a priest with his family, and some of them are having a hard time making a go of it these days, so they've become restaurants for very elegant food, or museums, and all sorts of things. Now the central, the guts of a Zen temple is what's called the Sodo. So in Japanese is the Sangha, the order of followers of the Buddha. Do simply means hall. So the Sangha hall, or Sodo, is the center. And this consists of a number of rooms, but the main one, the actual Sodo itself, is a large, long, spacious room with platforms on either side and a wide passage down the center. The platforms are 6 feet wide, and each contains a number of tatami mats, which are measure 6 by 3. And every monk is assigned to a mat. And on a shelf behind the mat against the wall, he has all his possessions, which are very simple. And so the mat is his sleeping place and his meditation place. There is an image of the Bodhisattva Manjusri in the hall, more or less in the center of the passage between the platforms. Manjusri is a bodhisattva, they call him Monju in Japan, who holds in his hand a sword. And this sword is the sword of wisdom, or prajna, which cuts asunder all illusions. That is the dwelling place and the meditation place of the monks. And then they have, of course, kitchens and a library and they have special temples that the monks use for various services. Then aside from that, there are the quarters of the Kansho, who is the abbot or administrative head of the temple, and then the quarters of the Roshi, who is the spiritual teacher. There isn't in the Zen, not in the Rinzai Zen school at any rate, exactly a hierarchy. Every temple is independent. There's no pope, no archbishop. But there is a fraternal relationship between all the temples of the Rinzai sect. The Soto sect have a little bit of a hierarchy, but still, on the whole, the Kansho, or administrative head of the temple, is the big boss. The Roshi is the respected boss, the man everybody's terrified of, at least on the outside, at any rate. Now, if you want to get into one of these institutions and study, they make it difficult. It's so different from the welcome attitude you get when you go into a Christian church. Here they repel you. Westerners, of course, are treated with a certain amount of courtesy that is not ordinarily accorded to Japanese. But even then, it's made difficult, because they realize that a Westerner who's taken the trouble to learn Japanese and to get himself over the oceans and to live under unfamiliar conditions is certainly pretty serious about it. And there are a number of Western Zen monks. So funny, there's one at Eheiji who comes from San Francisco, and he's tremendously tall. And to see him with all the others is quite amusing. Anyway, the formal approach is that you arrive in your traveling gear at the gate, and the Zen monk's traveling gear is most picturesque. He wears a great mushroom on his head, an enormous straw hat, about so wide, and then he has a black robe, rather shorter than a kimono, and he has white, long white tabi socks underneath, and gaita, which are the wooden sandals with bridges on them to keep you high up a bit. Or he may wear just plain waraji, which are straw sandals. Then he carries on the front his little box, in which are his eating bowls, his razor, his toothbrush, and such necessities of life. Well, when he arrives, he's told that the monastery is very poor, and they can't afford to take on any more students, and that the teacher is getting old, and it might tax his strength, and things like that. So he has to sit on the steps, and he puts his traveling box in front of him, he takes off his big hat, and he lays his head on the box, his forehead, and waits there all day. But he is invited in for meals to a special little guest house, because no traveling monk can be refused hospitality. And he is admitted at night into this special place, but he is expected not to sleep, but to spend all night in meditation. In olden times, this went on for at least a week or 10 days, to test this fellow out. Then finally, the assistant to the Roshi comes and tells him that the Roshi maybe would have a talk with him. So you must remember the aspect of a Roshi to this young monk. He's a formidable fellow. Usually an older man who has about him something that is difficult to put your finger on. There's a certain fierceness, coupled with a kind of tremendous directness, a sense of somebody who sees right through you. And so he really poses to this young fellow, "What do you want? Why did you come here?" But he said, "I came to be instructed in Zen." The teacher says, "Well, we don't teach anything here. There isn't anything in Zen to study." Well, the student knows, or thinks he knows, that this not anything which is studied in Zen is the real thing. That's, of course, as a Buddhist, he knows that what isn't anything is the universe, the great void, the shunyata. And so he isn't fazed by that. He says, well, nevertheless, you do have people